Order, present at the table are Senator Pierce, Vice Chairman, standing in for the absent, but we hope arriving soon, Senator Taylor, along with Senator Miller and Senator Ellis. It is 2 o'clock on the 29th of January. And we have before us today an executive order, that being EO-99, along with Senate Concurrent Resolution 1. I note that we have the Commissioner of Public Safety in the room for Executive Order 99. Why don't we go ahead and take the executive order, and then we'll move to the resolution. And Senator Duncan, I saw you come in. If you'd like to stay, you're certainly welcome to. If you'd rather we call you when we're ready for your resolution, we can do that also. So are you, sir, the spokesperson for the executive order? Oh, there are two. I'm sorry. I missed former representative, now Commissioner Boyer. Two captive.
Two.
As an audience. Two. Gentlemen, you have the chair. Have the floor.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Ron Oddy. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. Here today to talk about the Executive Order 99, which moves the Division of Motor Vehicles from the Department of Public Safety to the Department of Administration. You know, just to provide a little bit of history concerning the Motor Vehicle Division, I think it would be important to start out by at least acknowledging that each year, and certainly last year, there were a little over 3 million contacts by DMV employees with either members of the public at the counter or by mail in the state of Alaska. Each year, that same division collects about $36 million in revenue, 6.5 on behalf of local communities in the form of property taxes, 29 which goes to the general fund. We do put a little over $8 million back into the program to administer and run it each year. The program over the last 13 years has had added to it about 54 additional kinds of administrative requirements from a variety of agencies. And there's about probably another dozen or so that are pending. An example of what I'm talking about, in DOT and alone, there's $56 million in federal highway funds that are at stake because of programs that are now required to be administered by DMV, such things as commercial driver's licensing, emission inspection enforcement, heavy vehicle user tax, and odometer reading. Again, those four programs alone are an example of what I'm talking about when I say 54 have been added to the program in the last 13 years. DMV currently documents about $3 billion worth of titles for vehicles in the state each year. It is because of this kind of volume that I think the citizens of Alaska really are frustrated with the kind of service that they have received at DMV counters statewide. I think they're frustrated that they do spend $35 million a year in fees. They're not able to easily walk in and out of a DMV office and complete a simple business transaction. I think they're also frustrated because there are a variety of technological kinds of things that they see in the private sector, in the business community every day, and yet those kinds of technological advances have not made their way to DMV counters to sort of shorten the lines and make that easier. And I think it is frustrating to the public. Long before I got to state government, I was one of those people out there that used to complain about, I don't want to go to Tudor Road, don't necessarily want to go to Eagle River. And I've seen it from a different perspective the last 2 years. Because of all of this, I have talked with Commissioner Boyer about the kinds of things it would take to provide a solution to this particular problem. Historically, within the Department of Public Safety, DMV has competed with other public safety and life safety kinds of issues. And I think we would all agree, going back for the last 12 to 15 years, that they've not fared particularly well when they've competed with those kinds of interests. The limited management kinds of staff that I have available spend almost all of their time focused on life safety, public safety issues. The limited data processing staff that I have spend all of their time focused on trying to maintain our criminal history record system and those kinds of processes that support law enforcement and the criminal justice community. Just probably a recent example this week, Commissioner Boyer was in Anchorage. He did stop by DMV, was talking with the director about some kinds of business applications and solutions that might work to shorten the lines for DMV customers around the state. And I commend him for taking the time and the initiative to do that. While he was involved in those kinds of discussions, I also was meeting with my staff in Juneau talking about how we keep our automated fingerprint system working, functioning, and providing the kinds of fingerprint support that we need in this state to continue to identify and apprehend serious offenders. So it is those competing interests that have just sort of driven this issue with DMV for a long, long time, probably since it transferred to the Department of Public Safety over 20 years ago. In talking with Commissioner Boyer, I certainly agree and have him in agreement that what's really needed is a business solution. It's clear to me that Commissioner Boyer and his staff do have the interest and the resources to help DMV with this discussion and with the solutions. You know, for those reasons and probably more that I could elaborate on for some time, I think it's important that we do act positively on this, and certainly like to turn it over to Commissioner Boyer now for his comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mark Boyer, Commissioner for the Department of Administration. I'm very excited about this prospect, and I kind of want to hope that I not oversell the benefits of this transfer. But the bottom line here is that for at least the tenure that that I've been the Commissioner of Administration, we've tried to focus on the literally, to borrow the phrase from the governor, the customer side of the counter. And it's not something that he says lightly, nor I say lightly, but it's coming from the customer's perspective, and each of us, as it relates to DMV, our customer, either every year, every other year, but certainly more than occasionally. And it's with the customer's expectations in mind that this department, I think, is uniquely different from all other departments in being able to bring assistance to the process that takes place in DMV so that the customer gets the fast treatment, gets it right every time they interact and have a transaction with DMV, and it's fairly painless, the interaction. And that isn't universally the case today. It's not fast, right, cheap, or easy. Most times you have an interaction with DMV, and there are a whole host of reasons, and some of which the Commissioner of Public Safety has alluded to. His core business is fundamentally different than the core business of DMV. His core business is different. Basic fundamentals underlying the provision of that service are different than the underlying business fundamentals of what DMV is focused on. There's the conflict, I don't think, we don't think, we share the belief, won't go away as long as they're within the department. In the Department of Administration, a centralized administrative body has many of the tools available that we are, in theory, using for other departments to do their businesses better. To the extent that we're able to use finance and our ability to leverage finances in the market, our ability to use the personnel system in a way that gets a quicker turnaround and brings resources to bear much quicker. To the extent that we're able to use the procurement system more efficiently, quicker, to serve this particular interest. All of those things, or information services, not to forget the very important one here, information services technology and focus, bring those things all to bear at the right time, those things which are in fact our core business. That is the core business of the Department of Administration. We have a lot of other things that we do, but the core services budget, core focus of the department is to make other people's jobs, make their products better, faster, perfect where you can. But essentially, we are an enabler environment. And so it is not that we have an excess of resources, which one might conclude. It is that the resources we have at hand are the resources we need to bring to bear at DMV. I have been focused on the project for a number of months, and I have recently gone through, or was in Anchorage, and so had an opportunity to meet with people who represent the dealer, the automobile dealer's interest. They're very excited, I think, about the move. We are talking about a pilot project in Anchorage and in Fairbanks that will move a large part of the transaction as it relates to titling and registration of new vehicles out of the DMV office to their offices. And it will function a lot like those of you who have gone through a home purchase transaction. It'll operate much more like that, if not identically, like a home closing, where you go and you sit down with the closing officer, and at the end of the process, you've signed all the paperwork. There's an exchange of cash or money, check, money order, for a set of keys, and you walk away owning lock, stock, and barrel and owing a lot to a financial institution, but you walk away with the full ownership of that piece of property. The bank is satisfied. The broker, in that case, is satisfied. The transaction doesn't work that way today. The transaction isn't complete for somewhere between, on a good month, maybe a week, 3 weeks, to as long as 8 weeks before that transaction is complete, before the metal tag is literally delivered to the new owner of the automobile, and the banking and full transaction is done. It's up to at least that long in some cases before the transaction is finished. We're going to collapse that time so that when you sell a car as a broker-dealer or an agent, the deal is done when the people walk out with the keys and start driving the rubber and metal around. That'll be an incredible improvement in service, not only to the customer buying the new automobile, but to the stakeholder, major stakeholder in the whole deal. We're going to roll that pilot project out probably within the next 3 to 4 weeks. It's kind of bringing an expedited resolution to that issue that we're able to bring to bear, because I have people focused on the technology elements of it, the procurement elements of it, personnel issues related to it that aren't available in public safety. There are a number of additional things like that we're going to be able to do that'll make it have a different look, a different feel, a more efficient way of operating, and not cost any additional money from the general fund or program receipt environment. That's not going to be easy, but I'm trusting that in the budget process, if I'm given all the tools that are currently there, all the financial resources that are there, we can make this turnaround that will leave the public feeling as if they've had a major improvement in service through DMV, and I mean the entire set of publics, whether or not they're dealers or the person off the street that has to relate to them for a transaction, or the young person getting the first license or the driver's test for the first time. And it's going to be by using the full toolbox that's available to us to do that. And I'm pretty excited about it, and I think everyone I've talked with in that community is fairly excited about it. I'd be happy to answer questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I have one, and that was concerning section 2820.270, which is the suspension for non-payment of judgments. The department, about it a year ago, I think it was last summer or something, or made the decision they weren't going to enforce that law anymore. And that's one of the most effective collection tools that you have on a subrogation claim. With the insurance industry, and as a consequence, the failure to enforce that law on the part of our personnel places those people with very, very few other options available. this statute has been in effect since 1959, and it has always been enforced by our department. Literally, it's a very simple thing to do. Somebody brings in a certified copy of a judgment, they give it to us, and we pull that person's driver's license until such time as they've paid that judgment. It's really almost an automatic kind of a thing, and I can't imagine that it involves any real significant level of time or effort on the part of our personnel. And I'd just like to make certain that as this transition occurs, that practice of enforcing the existing laws that we have on the books, that'll start happening again. And I don't know which one of you would like to address that, but I want to make certain that I don't have to pass another law around here ordering somebody to enforce the law that's been on the books since 59.
Mr. Chairman, certainly I concur with you 100%, and I think everybody in DMV also does. When I sat in front of the Senate Finance Committee last year and shared with them that the budget that was before them, because of the increase in fixed costs, was going to reduce 14 positions in DMV, and the number of those were in driver services, we talked about that being a distinct possibility. My fear is that if we don't make the kinds of changes that are needed, the huge volume and increase in workload all across the board will continue to degrade the kind of services that really do need to be provided. It did take four people to administer that program. I do have Nita Hensley here who can probably talk to it further, but I will tell you that there are a couple of kinds of things going on that we think will allow them to get back into that business. But they are exactly the kinds of things that Commissioner Boyer is talking about in terms of trying to find some very significant efficiencies, electronic kinds of efficiencies with the personnel and the resources that are available now. And if we can make those changes, we think that we can start that program up again with the existing personnel.
I would just love, Mr. Chairman, to stamp that by saying, though, that it's not just an electronic fix. Technology is not going to solve the problems here. It's changing the flow of paper, the flow of business. It's process. We're bringing a process focus to bear. And we will be eliminating redundancies, eliminating handoffs, but going at the entire processes and sub-processes and identifying ways of reducing time, and we hope that by also shedding some business that's better provided by vendors or by the private sectors, with the instance of the dealers would demonstrate that it liberates people from work that they're now having to do in that environment to come in and do a higher, what we think is a higher value transaction or piece of business. So it's a whole host of things, and not just that technology is going to solve things, because it clearly won't by itself.
Well, I think many of us assumed last year when we implemented a program that instead of having every vehicle in the state registered and licensed and tagged every single year, that as we moved to a two-year program, that would literally cut that workload in half. And as a consequence of doing that, that there should have been some efficiencies result out of that. At least that was my understanding of what we were doing.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I don't have the exact figure, but I know in my conversations with DMV, when they've projected the workload of just the re-registration, the biannual registration, they estimate will reduce their workload by about 10%.
For the whole department?
Yes.
Yeah.
For the division.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to become an apologist for old business practices, but the way that business is done at DMV is not fundamentally changed over a good number of years, while the population and demands have increased. So everything that the legislature has done, taken the initiative to do, has helped them just manage to stay above water at all. And it's not until you really shake the fundamentals and restructure the way that they conduct business, then the process pieces, which sounds, it's terribly boring for anybody who doesn't appreciate that approach to doing business, but until you shake those fundamentals and turn it upside down and redesign the delivery, to get that next incremental improvement, and that's what we're going to hope to do. And the population continues to increase. Business doesn't, practice doesn't change. You're not going to be able to do it even with these incremental improvements.
Are there other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Anything further on this executive order? Anyone else who wish to testify? Pleasure of the committee. We've heard it. Now bless it, I guess. Are we ready to launch into some meaningful legislation? Senator Duncan, we have SCR1.
Beg your pardon?
You missed him calling this a meaningful piece of legislation.
Well, that worries me at the outset. Although, Mr. Chairman, Senator Taylor has indicated to me that he and I have both turned over a new leaf.
I'm always afraid of what you're going to find crawling up from under it.
So are all the rest of them.
Before this gets too far, go right ahead, Senator Duncan, and it's nice to have you here.
Well, pleasure to be here. I think it's probably the first opportunity I've had to ever appear before your committee. Only kidding. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you ready for me to proceed?
Great.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate you bringing up Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 1. It's not a new piece of legislation. It was introduced legislation was in the legislative body in the Senate, although it did not undergo a hearing at that time. So I appreciate your consideration of bringing it up for a hearing. Very simply, what the bill does is directs the legislature to consider hearing major pieces of legislation in other communities to bring more public involvement into the process and a greater understanding of the process with the public, and also, of course, to ensure that we have the input from people around this state. President, Mr. Chairman, the bill does require that between the 60th and 70th day of the session, assuming a resolution was passed by both houses in concurrence, that there would be a 10-day recess. And the purpose of that recess would be for committees to travel around the state to various communities to hold hearings on select pieces of legislation, and not only to hold hearings, which of course we can do now, but to be able to actually take action on that piece of legislation while in another community. It also requires that by the 50th day of the session there would be a notification published as to what committees would be traveling, where they would be going, and what bills would be heard, so that the public could be well informed and therefore could participate. And I chose that date thinking that by then the major issues of the session should be identified and well in mind, and that those would be the ones that would be taken to various communities to have hearings and to get people's participation. I believe the legislation recognizes that we need to do all we can to involve the public in the legislative process. It recognizes the responsibility we have to do that. We have done much, but I think there's more we can do. We have, of course, a good audio teleconferencing system. We've expanded to are expanding to two-way video teleconferencing. We, of course, have gavel-to-gavel coverage, which people can be more involved in the legislative process. And this is just one more step in opening the process up and getting more public involvement. So it recognizes that that's important and that we should try to involve as much of the public as possible. It also, I think, does one thing more, and that allows legislators who may have difficulty getting outside their community or Juneau, that they maybe they've traveled only to their community or Juneau, to travel elsewhere in the state to see how other communities, to visit other communities, to see the rest of the state and make direct contact with residents from other communities in the state. So I think it has several very positive benefits. And I think it does help open the process up and does it at a minimal cost, which I think is important also. I know there was a fiscal note prepared by Legislative Affairs of about $98,000. Of course, that fiscal note, again, would depend upon how many committees traveled, because it doesn't direct all of them do, and how many communities they visited, and what the major issues were. So that's the resolution in a nutshell, and it's an attempt to further help the public become involved in the legislative process and have impact on legislation that's before the legislature.
Thank you. Any questions? Hopefully you'll stand by.
I will.
Questions do arise. Next witness is Pam Gordian.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Pam Varney. I'm Executive Director of the Legislative Affairs Agency. And working with the sponsor and also Senator Taylor, we made several assumptions. We tried on the fiscal note to minimize the cost by looking at trying to coordinate as much as possible the meetings to try to minimize the travel costs. We have allowed in the fiscal note staff traveling, but that would naturally be up to the presiding officers if there was a need. And also in the fiscal note, we have allowed monies for advertising, public notice of these meetings, and that really varies depending on the size of the ad, and maybe we could look at consolidating some of those ads also. And there's also could be some efficiencies from this fiscal note if session per diem was going to be on a claim system, and we did not allow for that in the fiscal note because that really is up to the decision of the presiding officer. So I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions? Yeah, go right ahead.
Just a quick one. We mentioned you assume staff was coming. Did you mean committee staff or personal staff, or which one are you assuming? Or all.
Through the chair, Senator Parnell, it would be one staff member per standing committee, and that would probably be up to the chair of the standing committee asking the presiding officer if that staff person could assist. One of the assumptions that we made, if the staff was not allowed to travel, I'm sure our LIO officers, if they were not involved with other teleconferences at the time, they would be able to assist. So, but if they were busy during that time with other teleconferences, it might be a little difficult in some of the sites.
Do teleconference costs remain the same, or would they be increased by having committees in different spots around Alaska?
No, there would not be an increase.
Same price for the teleconference is held in Barrow versus Juneau.
That's correct.
Right. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there others who wish to testify? Mayor Egan?
I apologize, Mr. Chairman, for arriving late, so I didn't get this.
Give us your name for the
sign-up sheet for the file.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dennis Egan, mayor of the city and borough of Juneau. The community of Juneau takes its role and responsibility of Alaska's capital city very seriously. As mayor of Juneau, I am along with other members of the city and borough of Juneau assembly very open to ideas and initiatives that are advanced to enhance public satisfaction with Juneau as Alaska's capital city. By definition, a capital is, among other key functions, the place where the legislature meets. However, I do not recognize that holding a regular session of the legislature in the capital has not and should not preclude committees of the legislature from holding hearings in all regions of the state, to the extent that SCR1 further enables bringing the process to various regions of this vast state. I support this amendment to the uniform rules. Moreover, SCR1 would fit well into the recent set of initiatives that have been undertaken to improve access to the government process by our community. These initiatives are all actively supported by the City and Borough of Juneau Assembly, include statewide television coverage of the entire regular session of the legislature through gavel to gavel, enhanced audio and video teleconferencing of legislative and executive branch meetings, and access to government through the internet and other telecommunications improvements. These initiatives augment the excellent job that the 21 legislative information offices across the state are doing in providing essential information and assistance to the general public. Furthermore, passage of SCR1 would also be building upon these initiatives by giving legislators, regardless of the location of their home district, a greater opportunity to learn about the unique circumstances and challenges of Alaska's many communities and regions. And for all of these reasons, I and the Assembly of the City and Borough of Juneau support the passage of Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 1.
Thank you very much, Mayor. Any questions?
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on STR 1? Jim, if you might come back up, I just had one question myself, and that was, will we be running into any of the time limitation constraints that as an example, I think we've got 45 days from the time the legislature starts to take up matters having to do with the Boundary Commission. We have like 60 days to take up other things. Is this somehow going to need to be contemplated in this?
Mr. Chairman, I truly hadn't thought about that, but you're right. I think Boundary Commission is 45 days. Executive orders, I think we have to take action by the 60th day. So those would have to be, could not be part of that 10-day break for hearings in the rest of the state. So that, and of course, those are at least the executive order is a constitutional requirement. I guess the Boundary Commission is also.
I think they both are, yeah.
So
it's not 45 days from the first session.
Your pardon?
What is it? I can't
read the report.
Oh, when we receive the report, yeah.
Okay. But executive orders are 60 days, aren't they? Right. So, yes, to answer your question, yes, those time constraints wouldn't fit well with this resolution.
But I also don't know how they might be impacted either. I mean, something was moving towards a resolution on each of those, and they both take an action of the legislature to do anything, somebody's certainly going to have to review how that's going to impact the recess, so to speak.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but the 60th day would still be the 60th day, so maybe you have to move it to the 61st day. I understand what you're saying. It's about whether we'd be in session on the last day, and of course we could always do it on the 55th day, but knowing the legislative process, we might want to wait till the last moment for some reason, right?
I don't know how it works.
There's no requirement that we have to wait to the last day, to the 60th day, to overturn an executive order, but we might. But you're right. That I had not thought of that, Mr. Chairman, is if there are deadlines, constitutional deadlines for us to do certain things like executive orders,
right,
and if we were in recess, then we'd miss that constitutional deadline.
Yes. And by passage of this, we would actually end up with a uniform rule kind of mandating the recess, you know.
Except if you read the resolution, what it does say, it does mandate, but it also says, as I recall, on the first...
I think it's the majority changes it, don't we?
First page, it says that... let's see where it says. No, that's not it. Oh, it's on Rule 52. Or Section 2, it says, before 40th day of each regular session, the body shall consider the question of concurring in a recess in excess of 3 days by the other body during the period. So this doesn't mandate,
right,
but it says...
This says it shall come up.
Right, yeah.
Senator Parnell.
Senator, why did you select 10 days as opposed to 20?
Yeah, I was thinking 30, maybe.
I mean, what is it about 10?
You know, I don't think anything about 10. I mean, there was no magic to that number other than 10 days seemed like a reasonable amount of time. That would give us time to travel throughout the state to hold some hearings. It could be longer, could be shorter, I guess. There was no magic to that number other than the fact it seemed to me that a committee could visit two or three communities in that period of time, could set themselves up, travel out, visit two or three communities, be back, be ready to go to work on the 70th day of the session. There was no magic in the number 10. Maybe 5, maybe, I'm not sure.
Did you envision a standing committee like judiciary meeting in two or three different locations, or was it just kind of a one-time, did you have any ideas on that?
Well, actually, it'd be up to the committee chair and presiding officer, but I would envision, for example, let's say if tort reform was the issue, right, that the committee might want to take tort reform and go to Ketchikan and go to Anchorage and the Fairbanks and Kodiak and Nome and have some hearings where people could, I mean, there's been that public process already with the committee that was set up by the administration and that people participated in, but allow people then to have the opportunity to testify directly to a committee that's holding hearings on that major piece of legislation. And that's what I more or less had in mind. I think there are some very major pieces of legislation identified each session, some that are attract great public attention, are very critical pieces of legislation, and that the committees who were in charge of those could then be sure that they heard from everybody in the state and people got a chance to participate. I didn't envision every committee taking every little piece of legislation trying to hold hearings, but and I don't even think every committee would probably do this, but major committees would.
And what I was looking at is in that 10-day period, if you've got judiciary traveling to three different places, and you know, in the Senate, as you know, we all serve on numerous right. standing committees. It would be a nightmare to try to accomplish all that in 10 days, but I was trying to figure out what your intent was with the committees.
Yeah, I didn't have any magic on the number. I mean, it was just my intent that I think there's an obligation to continue to try to open the process up more, and as I've said, we've done that to a great extent, and I just see this as another step in that process of, in addition to video and audio teleconferencing, allowing people to sit here and directly talk to the committees.
Some may find that concept bizarre that you suggested, but in fact, Senator Duncan, this committee did hold hearings on the tort reform legislation in Sitka, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and even Kotzebue. Maybe had we been able to do so during the session itself by taking a break, as your legislation suggests, we might have had more attention focused at that time on those hearings. They were very well attended. We had a lot of participation.
Mr. Chairman, unless I'm mistaken, you held those hearings, but under our rules, you weren't allowed to take formal action of amending the legislation or making changes in the legislation. And this would allow that to happen. And that's one of the frustrations I think I often hear is that people will testify by teleconference and participate, but they never really get to see the bill being marked up and acted on. Or even if you take your committee on the road, you take the hearings, and then they never really know why their ideas weren't considered or if they were considered even.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions? Why to the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
There are no other witnesses, I don't think. Senator Miller?
Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 1 out of committee with the recommendation.
Any objections? There being no objections, bill moves from committee. Thank you, Senator Duncan.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.